Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Walter Isaacson, whose new book is The Greatest Sentence Ever Written. It's always fascinating to see what New Orleanian Walter Isaacson is up to. The Leonard Lauder Professor of American History and Value at Tulane University, he is the author of best-selling biographies of Ben Franklin, Henry Kissinger, Albert Einstein, Steve Jobs, Leonardo da Vinci, Jennifer Doudna, and Elon Musk. And all that in addition to leading Time, CNN, and the Aspen Institute. Today we're talking about his new book, The Greatest Sentence Ever Written. Walter, welcome!
Oh, Susan, it's so great to talk to you again.
I'm sure if our listeners had time to think about it, they'd come up with the sentence you're referring to. But since you're right there, tell us what it is.
The greatest sentence ever written, in my mind, is the second sentence of the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and they're endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You could argue maybe some other sentences are greater, but the human hand writing a sentence like that changed the world more than anything and gave us our mission as a nation, which I hope we can rally around for our 250th birthday.
And in this pretty little book, you have the actual text is in papers, so we can see it.
Yeah, I have the first draft is the in papers. What people don't know is there were five drafts of the Declaration. And Jefferson does the first draft, but he gives it to Benjamin Franklin and John Adams. And he writes a wonderful letter to Benjamin Franklin saying, oh, would the good Dr. Franklin, the great editor, help me edit this document? People were much nicer to editors back then than when you and I were in journalism. And John Adams adds to it. And so I show how they each wrote in things on that second sentence to help improve it. And I'm hoping that for the 250th birthday, this book will inspire the Library of Congress and the National Archives to display the first version of the Declaration right next to the final version.
Oh, I hope so. But one of the things that's so interesting is that, well, you and I know what this is like. You offer up a text to someone else's opinion, and then you get it. Or you get, suggested revisions. And Thomas Jefferson's feelings got a little hurt.
Oh, he was furious, especially when they started cutting out all the sections near the end. And Benjamin Franklin had to calm him down because this was the whole Congress was trying to edit it, all 60 of them there. And Benjamin Franklin told him a story, which is in the book, about a hat maker who wanted a sign made at Benjamin Franklin's print shop. And the sign said, so-and-so makes hats for ready cash in the marketplace. And everybody edited it. And finally, the guy said, I'm just going to have a picture of a hat, and that'll be it. So that's Ben Franklin's sense of humor. But the main thing for me was the editing of that second sentence, we hold these truths sentence.
And Ben Franklin, I had forgotten, and I was so glad you pointed it out, how close we were to the end of Ben Franklin's life here.
He's older. He's twice as old as the average age of other people at the Continental Congress. He's in his 70s, and by the time they do the Constitution, he's in his 80s. And back then, 80 was considered rather old, unlike today. But Benjamin Franklin was not the most brilliant of the founders. You'd probably say Thomas Jefferson and Madison might be there. Or the most passionate. That was John Adams and his cousin Samuel. nor was he a man of like great stature like George Washington. But he was the wisest, and he used the wisdom of his ages to help edit this document and to make this greatest sentence ever written.
So you follow in his footsteps by giving this a close, close reading, word by word, concept by concept. I have to confess, I was kind of hoping you would diagram it somewhere. Yeah.
You know, maybe I should do that. I tried to, it's like, okay, maybe we should make this a graphic. But it's in the book, each book, and it's a very short book. It's only about 45 pages of text.
But there's a lot here.
I know, but each chapter is about a word or a phrase, like we, mm-hmm. and self-evident truths, and endowed by the Creator.
Well, let's talk about all men. You know what everybody's going to say. What's this, you know?
Well, that was the interesting thing, because I asked, when they say all men, do they mean mankind in general? Because sometimes when people wrote about the rights of man or, you know, they were meaning it in an expansive way.
Of course.
But no, not in this case. They really did just mean men, and they also meant free white men, and to some extent, sometimes property owners. And so that's the thing we have to wrestle with on this sentence, is that talk about all men are created equal. Those are Jefferson's words, and yet he's enslaved more than 400 people.
Right.
And that becomes part of the process of, no, this is not a description of what our country is. This is an aspiration. This is something we're going to have to work for 250 years or more to try to make the aspiration in that sentence true. And even Jefferson knew that. He knew the contradictions in him saying that. But it does set a mission statement where we can improve, self-improve as a nation.
Mm-hmm. You've traveled through so many different time periods in your work in writing these biographies, and this is a period that's familiar to you because of your work on Franklin. So what was it like to revisit it with all the stuff you've learned along the way? I mean, you give this such a rich context, such a sense of what the founders were thinking and reading and saying to one another. And that's revelatory for it will be for a lot of readers, I think.
Well, I do reach back to even the days as a graduate student when I was studying John Locke and Berkeley uh-huh. and Hume and John Stuart Mill, because these are the people that Jefferson and Franklin were reading at the time. And that notion of what do we mean by we? Well, it means a social contract where, just as we say in the Constitution, we the people come together. But I also hope this book also relates it to the present, because I was writing it having been thinking about, wrestling with how polarized we are these days, how
right.
bitter our fights are, how partisan everything becomes, like whether or not you're going to wear a mask during COVID. It's not an issue about your health. It's a political statement. And I'm thinking, all right, maybe for our 250th birthday, it's like a family that sometimes doesn't fully get along, but we're having a big birthday. So let's all come together and try to get along, at least for 1 year. And the way to do that, I thought, was by all of us appreciating and wrestling with each word in this sentence, and understanding how it's our common ground as a nation. And so maybe by just all agreeing that we're going to understand this sentence better, it will help us put aside some of our ideological and partisan differences, at least for a year having a birthday party.
A nice birthday party. Big one, let's hope.
You know, I remember, and so do you, Susan, although you're a bit younger than me, when we got through Vietnam and Watergate and the riots in the cities, and it was just after that, we had the 200th birthday, the bicentennial in 1976. And suddenly, after a period of turmoil, we were able to come together for a nationwide bicentennial celebration. My goal with this book is if people really appreciate the Declaration and this sentence, we might all come together and do a 250th national party like that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Walter Isaacson. We're talking about his new book, The Greatest Sentence Ever Written. So you've seen the originals. So what is that like for you as an historian?
You know, I just went to the archives in the Library of Congress and even did it with C-SPAN. They're running it in the next couple of weeks, of looking at the document itself, the declaration there in the rotunda of the National Archives. But even more exciting to me is looking at that first draft where Jefferson writes, "We hold these truths to be sacred." Mm-hmm. And you see Benjamin Franklin's printer's pen. You can see these black backslash marks that he makes, a printer would make, and crossing out sacred and putting self-evident. And so it was so exciting to think, oh my goodness, this is the actual piece of parchment, the actual writing paper that Franklin's own pen touched, and this is how he changed that sentence.
The whole idea of the hand that touched the hand, you know what I mean?
Yeah. You know, I actually felt that same way when I did my Leonardo da Vinci book and got to Venice. And up on the fourth floor of the Academy there, they brought out and showed me Vitruvian Man, that naked guy doing jumping jacks in the circle and square. And you could see the protractor point where Leonardo had made the circle. And I think if we just got a thrill, as we even looked at replicas of the Declaration of Independence, that might help make us all hang together a little bit instead of always being so disputatious, as Franklin would say.
Well, I love that you still have your love for paper after writing about all these high-tech
books. It's a wonderful technology, Susan. It's got an infinite battery life. Its operating system never goes out of style. So when you look at the papers they actually wrote, you feel a connection to history.
I love that you even know the font that it was printed in.
You know, this is so amazing to me. And my book, by the way, if you
people get it, same one.
Uses the same font. Because when he was very young, Benjamin Franklin, I think just in his late teens, he goes to England because he wants to become a printer. He has to buy print. You know, he has to buy the fonts, the actual casting of the printing letters for his print shop. And he buys it from a person named William Caslon, who was a punch cutter and type designer in England back then. And he brings it back to Philadelphia, and it becomes known as Caslon font, named after the punch maker. And Benjamin Franklin used it throughout his career. And then he gets to help print the first copies of the Declaration. And the broadside that was sent to George Washington to read to the troops and others. And he used Caslon type. So I asked the publisher of this book, please let me use Caslon type as the type in this book.
Ah, oh, sweet. And you even know what desk Jefferson wrote it on.
You know, his famous little mahogany desk that he made in Monticello and brought with him is like a lap desk. And so he has an apartment on Market Street he's rented. And he and Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson are there as they go through the drafts. But also imagine not only the desk, but he had a young enslaved assistant named Thomas Hemings, who was very young and, you know, helped him as a valet, one of his slaves. But later on, Thomas's sister, Sally Hemings, becomes Jefferson's mistress. So these are the complexities of a person like Jefferson that we shouldn't try to shy away from. We should understand the human beings who created our country, both for good and also the contradictions that even Jefferson knew were part of his life.
Well, if you don't mind, I'd like to take just one little diversion along my personal passion. One of the things that you describe when you're describing the American dream is you quote from James Truslow Adams, The Epic of America. And he uses the Library of Congress as an example. And I love it that time and time again, libraries come up as a value people should have in common.
Ben Franklin starts that because he forms a group of young tradesmen in Philadelphia, and they say, what can we do for the civic good? What can we put in the commons? And my book is sort of about the commons, which is the old place in England and then in America, where even if you didn't own land, you could graze your herd on the commons. That's where you have a Boston Common or a Cambridge Common. But Franklin said we should also have a library in common so that we could, even if you didn't own a lot of books, everybody could learn as much as even the wealthiest aristocrats in England, because we would have a public library. And so that becomes, for Franklin, the symbol of how we create a land of opportunity where we put certain things in common. He also created an academy for the education of youth that becomes the University of Pennsylvania. He created a hospital, a night watchman corps. These are the things we come together to do, not simply as individuals, but working in association with others. And I call that in the book our commons. And the library is a wonderful reality of it, but also a symbol of it.
Oh, and I think with such pleasure of the Library of Congress and the National Archives, you know, they're just great gifts to all of us. But talk a little bit more about common ground, because that's the great lesson you find for this fractious time in history, because that's what democracy depends upon.
Right. When I talked about the commons just now, meaning the place where people got to graze their herds, it wasn't done just out of generosity. It was done because everybody deserved the opportunity to try to make a living, and you wanted everybody to have some stake in society, so that, you know, they would support being part of, you know, we hold these truths or we the people. And so to me, what they create and what we're still debating is how much should be totally private property, and how much should be in the commons. And back with Benjamin Franklin, it was sort of decided that police and fire departments should be in the commons, that we shouldn't each have our individual night watchmen and fire people. We should say that's part of the commons. So was national defense. A hospital was. A widows and orphans fund, like we might call Social Security is these days.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you don't want everything to be in the commons, because great enterprise comes from allowing private property. But our big debates these days, and we just had one the past week or two on healthcare, is how much should it be something that we can all share and have common access to, and how much should it be private and should be paid for privately? Well, those are tough questions, but what our founders teach us is there's a balance we have to strike, and people are going to disagree, but it's not the end of the world. It's just a question of how much are we putting in the commons, how much are we keeping in as part of the private sphere? And if we frame it this way, we can say, well, I understand the other side. It's not, we don't have to shut the government down just because we can't figure out healthcare. We ought to figure out how much of it should be in, you know, a common good that everybody has access to, how much of it should be a private good. And that's true of a lot of our debates. And so I just want us to go back to understand the value of having some things be commonly shared, because it makes a land of opportunity. That's why we have public schools and common libraries and common schools, is even if you're born poor, you should have the opportunity to succeed. And so I'm trying to help us understand through that sentence that it's a question of balance of what are common goods and services that we have, what are private goods and services, and how do we make a balance so that everybody feels they have a stake in our democracy, and everybody feels that their kids will have an opportunity to succeed.
Do you feel hopeful, Walter, right now? I mean, things seem so fractious. And
I think they're fractious, but we've gone through worse times, you know, certainly the Civil War. And even when I was in college, they were taking over buildings, and there were riots going on, Vietnam and civil rights and Watergate. We tend to come out of these. Einstein was very upset during the McCarthy period of the early 1950s when people were losing, you know, their rights because of the attacks on communism. And he said, I saw this happen in Nazi Germany. I saw this happen with the communists when I was growing up. But then it righted itself. Eisenhower got us out of it, Edward R. Murrow. And Einstein says, American democracy has a gyroscope. It knows how to right itself when things look particularly bad.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Walter Isaacson. We're talking about his new book, The Greatest Sentence Ever Written. This is such a short book for you. It's short and elegant and very pretty. I mean,
yes, you know,
it's a pleasure to hold. And I'm curious about how you got to drilling down to a single sentence, which for you is such a different thing.
Well, I think you're politely saying that my other books are too long.
No.
I really wanted, I'll tell you one reason. I had this person, Leonard Lauder, who's always been generous, both at the Aspen Institute and, as you mentioned at the very beginning, endowed the professorship here at Tulane that I now hold. And he was hitting 90 years old. And he says, I'm worried about democracy. I want you to write a pamphlet, just like Thomas Paine wrote a pamphlet, Common Sense. Write a pamphlet defending democracy. And I said, well, I don't, people don't read pamphlets these days. I said, maybe I'll do a podcast. And they said, no, I want you to, and said, all right, I'm going to do a short book. And the way I'm going to approach it is we're going to understand democracy through the most important sentence ever written to help create a democracy. And so that's why I decided to focus on that sentence, which I'd been interested in for a long time, because I had seen that first draft. Now, figure each of those words in that sentence is interesting. Why don't I try to do a book that just explores the sentence?
Well, you've done so many books that take on such big panoramic subjects, you know, and it was kind of a pleasure to see you do this, like hold it up like a prism and see it crack into all its different colors and meanings. It was really
different. Susan, this is why I've always been glad to be your friend and love the way you cover books, as you have for many years.
Well,
and books can be our common ground too, don't forget.
Amen.
Libraries are important, but libraries only exist because we have books.
Hey, well, keep it up. Get back to work, Walter. I mean, we've been talking with Walter Isaacson, whose new book is The Greatest Sentence Ever Written. You can meet him Saturday, November 29th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
What's on tap in the literary life this week? Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, gets underway Wednesday and runs through Saturday, November 22nd at the Andre Caillou Center on Bayou Road. Check out the complete schedule at wordsandmusic.org. Some events to consider Thursday at 2, art, climate change, and the Louisiana landscape with Stacy Balkin, Bruce Sunpie Barnes, Hallie Dardar, Frank Rell, Brad Richard, and Jack Bedell. And it's not too late to get tickets to Friday's Literature and Lunch session, which will feature the winners of the Patty Friedman Writing Competition. Richard Petrie comes to sign the paperback edition of Sudden Death, The Green Bay Packers, The Baltimore Colts, and the NFL, 1965. Saturday, November 15th from 11 a.m. to noon at Octavia Books. Poet Jonathan Penton reads from and signs his new book, A Limited Number of Miracles, A Walk Through the New Orleans Sculpture Garden, Tuesday, November 18th at 8 at Bar Redux. Bob Becker signs Going South, Wednesday, November 19th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Friends of the UNO Library work hard all year raising funds for the library. Their next effort is the Friends of the Library Book Sale and Fundraiser, Thursday, November 20th from 10 to 6, Friday, November 21st from 10 to 4, and Saturday, November 22nd from 10 to 2. It takes place in the fourth floor of the UNO Library, 2000 Lakeshore Drive, free and open to everyone. Bill and Bobby Malone sign Writers in the Sky, Romancing the West with Music and Humor, and appear in conversation with Patrick Maney, Thursday, November 20th at 6 at Octavia Books. And Walter Isaacson signs The Greatest Sentence Ever Written, Saturday, November 29th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Now, coming up in December, 8 local authors of children's books will discuss and sign their work Tuesday, December 2nd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. They are Gary Olipio, author of Craziest Cajun Football Tale, Shannon Kelly Atwater, author of Fade O'Doe, Adam Dennis, author of Gary and the Tooth Fairy and the Boy from the Swamp, Michelle Dumont, author of Phoebe Cakes and Friends and Alphabet Tale, Learn Your ABCs, Maddie Hannon, author of Scrim on the Run, Dr. Alice Hoyt, author of Wally the Seafood Allergic Walrus, Anna Romano Johnson, author of Real River Rats, and Aaron Roven, author of The Little Bee Tree. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.